Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and you're listening now to our gathering of a week's worth of culture stories, which this time introduces us to the heart of the Kurdish music scene in Leitrim, the Italian financier, without whom we might never have heard of Charlie Chaplin, Walt Disney or United Artists. The Dublin musician Checkerboard explains the magic window that is the album cover, and Orit Gat engages with the Elizabeth Line and the art of Douglas Gordon. But it's in Carrick-on-Shannon for a quick cup of sweet, thick coffee that our voyage begins. Mohammed Sifkin's exile from Syria saw the Kurdish musician wind up in Leitrim and discover there a welcoming international music scene. This included Willie Stewart, founder of local underground label Nya Records. They've just released a first Irish album, I Am Kurdish, from Mohammed Sifkin. Culture File's Quaylen McNamara went to sample some music and some coffee.
Arabic coffee.
It was okay, different this, but this name says.
That's the name of the instrument.
Yeah. He have five strings. This maybe, يعني ممكن أي بيت كردي.
Almost all the family, the Kurdish family, and most of the Arabic family, maybe they have one of these at home, he says.
Yeah.
Play anything you want with this one, and all of these black lines here, then they are like tones. It can, any one of them will give you the different tones.
I am Mohammed Saib. I'm Kurdish. I'm from Syria, but now I'm from Ireland. Maybe you ask me, who are you? I speak, I'm Kurdish. I write this this song, I am Kurdish, in my heart. My heart I write. In Syria, the government kill Kurdish because Kurdish not good. ISIS kill Kurdish because Kurdish not good. My first son, my big son, number one, ISIS kill him because he Kurdish, only Kurdish. I write for my heart because everything I write, I understand what I write. This for Kurdish.
I'm Willie Stewart. I run Nya Records here in County Leitrim. I used to DJ for events in Carrick-on-Shannon that were organised by the local international group. Basically a group of people from all different countries that had all moved to Carrick-on-Shannon. They wanted to get together to celebrate their culture. So I was at the Dock Arts Centre in Carrick doing my thing, and place was packed, you know, and then this guy in like a leather jacket holding a bazooki case just sort of walks in, and I clocked him immediately. And I was like, who's this lad, you know? So he walks up to me and he just basically hands me his cable for his bazooki and goes, where do I plug in? And I was like, what? Like, who are you? Like, no one told me there was going to be live music. So we figured it out. I managed to hook him up into the PA and he played. And like everybody there just started dancing, like traditional kind of Kurdish dance. And it was like, whoa, I feel like I've been waiting for this lad for years.
When I play, maybe my brother really understand. Where I play, maybe everybody happy. When I play in my music here in Dublin, in Sligo, in Cork, everybody happy and dance. I'm from Syria, you know, I'm refugees, I'm coming here. My language, maybe you see now, my language not good. Maybe you don't understand me, but anybody musician coming here, I play, he play. Maybe he understand what I play, I understand what he play. What I remember in my country, I give him in music and song, he understand. The language, I think not sure good. Maybe you speak Arabic or you speak Kurdish or you speak Turkish, but music, world language. ما ظل صبر بينا مر بينا مر بينا بين
I started up Nya Records 2 years ago and I always wanted to record an album for Mohammed. It just, for some reason, because of whatever life, took a long time to get going, but eventually we got him into the studio and we managed to commission him through funding then to pick two musicians that he would like to record with. So he picked Emer Reedy and Cathal Roach. So they had a couple days rehearsal and then we got them into the studio. So that was half the album was done that way. And then a year or so later, I got him back into the studio eventually to finish off the album. And that was all solo stuff. There's a small bit of resistance in Ireland at the moment to, you know, people coming in here from different countries, which is very sad and ironic because, you know, Ireland is probably one of the biggest nations of emigres in the world. But the fact that people just are really embracing the music and Mohammed himself is a really good sign, I think, for Irish society.
The people from Ireland, good and nice. I don't know, but good and nice.
I think that the Irish people are very lovely and kind people to everyone here. They have not any discriminate between who I am, Kurd or Arab or Turk or where I am coming from. I think I am very, very happy that I am living here in Ireland and thank God that finally I got my path to here in Ireland. He says the Irish people, they are people, they are struggling for, they lack freedom, they like they don't hate anyone and they respect everybody.
Yeah, I happy.
And the side one we can't
come. Yeah, I very happy. Because everybody relax and good. No any crazy in here. I live here maybe 6 years, but here everything okay, good.
Mohammed Sifkan there, and I Am Kurdish is on Nya Records, which you can find on Bandcamp. A fresh voice note in the chat next on Culture File. Douglas Gordon is a Scottish artist known particularly for employing cinema as a medium and a subject in works such as his Zonked Hitchcock Hack, 24-Hour Psycho. Gordon's latest show in London includes sightings of that key work, but also spills out of the gallery into the streets of central London and even onto the underground, interesting itself 4 decades later as much in words of love as depraved killers. This is Orit Gat. Voice notes.
Pick up the old ring phone mounted to the wall by the entrance to Gagosian Gallery in London and listen to the voices reading the same sentence in multiple languages. From the moment you hear these words until you kiss someone with brown eyes, a woman, from the moment you hear these words, then the same thing in Italian, in German. Those same words appear on the wall just by the phone. A text artwork for those too shy to pick up the phone in a gallery. It's not just the kissing and the brown eyes. There's a romantic tone to much of Douglas Gordon's new exhibition. It's called All I Need Is a Little Bit of Everything, and the gallery is full of text works in different forms. Vinyl lettering on the wall, neons, words engraved into the wall, specifically a huge one at the entrance reading, I am the author of my own addictions, with all the plaster left over scattered on the floor underneath it. The words hang in the air. Take me, I'm yours, in Times New Roman font, by the floor of the next room. I have forgotten everything, interspersed with the same line in French, j'ai tout oublié. The words scattered and repeated on the whole wall, life after life after life, left to the viewer to continue. When you move language out of its place, out of context, the words end up taking on whatever meaning you see. There's a long tradition of art and text where artists introduce language into the exhibition space, knowing that a viewer is not a reader, that those words shift and change and develop a much more elusive, suggestive meaning when shown. In 1967, American artist Bruce Nauman made a very famous swirling neon work reading, "The true artist helps the world by revealing mystic truths." I look at a photo of it to confirm the exact wording, my head tilting to the right even when looking at an image. In the early 2000s, Tracy Emin made a pink neon heart, and inside it, writing in cursive blue, "Love is what you want." How do you read these works? Do you read them like a book or like a street sign? I say there's a romantic tone to it all, and it comes from this suggestive, dreamy quality that words take on when you read them, that is, when you encounter them in a gallery.
Next station, Tottenham Court Road.
Leave Gagosian and walk up Davis Street. You can catch the Elizabeth Line from Bond Street to Tottenham Court Road. Take the escalators up, where you'll see a new public video work by Gordon called Underground and Overheard, all in one word. In the video, sentences run across a black background. It's so minimal, almost unobtrusive. It has no sound, so the station's life becomes the soundtrack. The sentences go, "Remember me, I remember you. Nothing can be hidden forever, and nothing will be the same." There are phrases in many languages, multiple alphabets, and a single spirit of something pretty, loose, and impossible to define. Here is where we all meet. This animated video work combines these text works with what is Gordon's main medium, film. The Scottish artist has made an upward of 40 videos since the 1990s, and there are two video works at Gagosian. Or you could say one video work. The other is many works in one. The new video, 2023 East-West Girls Boys, also all one word, is a close-up of an eye with a word printed on it. For example, non-stop, bang, girls, boys, windmill, majestic, playland, naked. It comes out of the iris as if it's what the eye sees or something projected onto it. Looking at it feels uncomfortable and intense and way too close. Oh, and it's slow, slower than blinking. The other is a huge installation, an ongoing piece begun in 1999 called Pretty Much Every Film and Video Work from About 1992 Until Now. The title explains it all. It's a massive circle of screens, computer monitors, televisions, iPhones and iPads, flat screen TVs, and those chunky old square monitors, each of which shows one of Gordon's previous video works. Whenever he makes a new film, he adds a screen to it and sends a file to the museum that owns this installation. When I am there, Gordon's most famous work, 24-Hour Psycho from 1993, in which he slowed down Alfred Hitchcock's famous 1960 thriller Psycho to 2 frames per minute, meaning it runs for 24 hours, is in the credit section, so its effect is quite dimmed. Beyond it, I recognize feature film from 1999, where a double projection focuses on the head and hands of a conductor splitting the action from the emotion showing on his face. He's conducting the score to Hitchcock's Vertigo, no sound, no tension. There are dozens of screens showing different works, from a video of a stranded boat floating along a river to other pieces appropriating old Hollywood cinema. The sounds clash. There's music and steps, chatter in a bagpipe, a metallic hiss. The display is not linear, and there isn't a list of films included. It's a jumble, an intensity. What does a body of work look like? Here is a new suggestion. This is a video work, but it's not meant to be watched, really. Experienced may be a better term for it. It feels related to my question on how to read the text pieces. The answer is you approach this work without any cynicism, allowing it to be overwhelming, tender, and still elusive. It's a lesson in looking at art. Sometimes you have to let things remain undetermined, even if they feel like they should be easy to read. On the building's front facade are a few vinyl texts. "It's coming," as you turn toward the gallery from Davis Street. "I just want to talk to you on the other end." Only when I leave and turn the corner do I realize that it's only half the work. It starts, it doesn't matter who I am, and wraps around the building's corner. It doesn't matter who I am, I just want to talk to you. On the couch in front of 2023 East West Girls Boys is a small pile of postcards reading, "Dear, I know you're not there. Yours, Douglas." I take three. I want to send one to someone who is not there. Another small gesture of romance, like getting off the tube and thinking about someone you remember. If I send it, I'll be keeping this exhibition moving through the world.
Orit Gat's voice notes there, and Douglas Gordon's All I Need Is a Little Bit of Everything runs at Gagosian Grosvenor Hill, London, until March 15th, and the screen work Underground Overheard is on display at the Dean Street entrance to the Elizabeth Line at Tottenham Court Road Station. Oblique Strategies for Doing Things Differently next. Checkerboard is the nom de guitar of musician and designer John Lambert. His latest album, Souvenir, has been nearly a decade in gestation. Lambert at one time was seemingly omnipresent on the Irish music scene, with his sets involving his dense finger-picking guitar style, married with tech such as the Loop Station, which allowed him to build up layers of floating sound as a kind of electronic one-man band. It was an approach that was mirrored in his attitude to the design of his release, which he also undertook alone. Eventually, however, the approach became unsatisfying to Lambert, who began consciously to look for ways of leaving it behind. John Lambert came to Culturefile Towers to talk about that process.
In the space between The Unfolding and Souvenir, I've done a lot of listening to stuff like Brian Eno talk about the process of making Low with David Bowie and whatnot. Just the cards, the curious oblique strategy cards, and the value in doing something completely different. When I'm looking at what I can challenge myself to do to move away from it's just patterns and things I've done to death, really, you know. So I had certainly been doing that live show of just having the Loop Station. I'd done that endless times, and I sort of, to the extent that I decided to not do any more live shows, I was so tired of it. And so I was doing about one live show a year from, you know, 2014 up until last year. So I think, yeah, it needed something drastic. The elements of the format of music and that are quite very unusual are, you know, song titles and the album artwork. They frame the music in a way that can be harnessed to create something sort of quite unique. You sort of think of that as a window or as a place where the music lives or it belongs. And you know, it's an unusual square, that kind of looking glass into that little world. I would think of that as something to aspire to trying to create an ecosystem, if you like, or a little world where these songs are relate to each other. They can be associated to this visual. It could just seem harmonious, you know, that's something to aim for. I was just thinking about how long, when this album started. I was trying to pinpoint roughly around the time this album started. I remember it was originally going to be called Territory, and it was sort of going to be very classical tinged and quite desolate and quite stark. I was thinking sort of large grey landscapes and dark sort of cloudy weather, and Territory being the sort of a title meaning, you know, territory between, on an emotional level, sort of a territory between people, borders, lines, and, you know, loosely that was a theme or something I wanted to do. And I had some of the songs written, but I met my wife Katie shortly after that, and when I think about when we got married, and we have two little boys now, and we have a family, and like, life's completely changed, and you know, and it's now become a completely different album. During that journey, it became a different album. It's got has a lot of joy in it.
Checkerboard, aka John Lambert, there, and his latest album, Souvenir, is on Bandcamp, and he'll be playing live at the Sugar Club in Dublin on Saturday evening. Tickets from thesugarclub.com. In common with our guest, filmmaker Valentina Signorelli, you'll be forgiven for starting off a little bit vague on the Italian-American banking pioneer Amedeo Pietro Giannini. Although he's hardly celebrated even in Italy, Giannini was the founder of the Bank of Italy, a bank servicing early 20th century immigrants to America's West Coast. It later became the Bank of America. Giannini and his bank have a key role in inventing and funding Hollywood, from backing Walt Disney to financing the homes of the stars. It's a story Signorelli tells in her documentary, A.P. Giannini, Bank to the Future, but also a story of which, growing up in Italy, she knew nothing at all.
Unfortunately, he's not well known. I don't know why. And that's why we're also making a documentary, to make sure that such an important figure, not just for the Italian community or for Italy or the migrant communities to the US, but, you know, many migrant communities to the US and by extension, the whole American economy and history. We don't know why he's not well known, but that's why we're doing the documentary.
Who's your hero? My hero's a banker.
And this was the Bank of Italy, which was a funny name to start your bank in California. Or perhaps, I mean, evidently quite a good idea.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't just Giannini. It was Giannini and the board of directors, and they were all Italian. So somehow, on the one hand, we're talking about the same decades where the stereotypical image of the Italian migrant starts hitting, you know, news and even early cinema. And so somehow they were deconstructing that stereotype, or maybe they were speaking to the Italian community in California. That was one of the most discriminated migrant communities in California, but also was open to everybody else.
That's one of the things you explore in the film, because you have this sort of central narrator character who's speaking in English but with a strong Italian accent and discussing just the kind of atmosphere into which Italian immigrants and immigrants in general arrived to America at the time.
Yeah, so our narrator is actually a fictional character. So it's a scripted part that it's performed by Giorgio Cantarini, who was the kid in The Gladiator and in Life is Beautiful. And now, of course, he's grown up. And we decided to include that character because when we started interviewing the descendants of the Italian-American community in the U.S., all of them always pointed out the names and the bad names that were used against Italians. And I guess the most common one was Dago. Which is a very offensive word, so kind of an equivalent to the N-word, but addressed to Italians.
You don't call it the D-word, though.
No, because I'm Italian, so somehow I can have the privilege of using it. But interestingly enough, because I grew up in Italy, I had no idea about that. Whereas for the Italian-American descendants, that's a very offensive term to use. And we decided to use the word because possibly today in the 21st century, when we think about the stereotypical image of Italians, we think about mafia movies or con artists or some characters that are very funny to watch from the outside. But actually, that's the history of very long discrimination that is still filtered out throughout the decades, and it's still present today in different forms. So we thought it was important to use it because the people that we interviewed used that. And so we thought, okay, that's the essence of documentary. It's an important part for them, so we're going to use them. And I know we know that, especially the opening of the film where we make a summary of the main swear words that were used against Italians and the bad names, some people found it offensive. But it's good to remember, because the people that found it offensive are not Italian-American. Italian-Americans, everyone who watched the film told us, I wish my grandmother was here tonight, or I wish my grandfather was here tonight to watch this film. Giannini's first background was about agriculture, but I would say his main interest was innovation. So, and we can see that throughout his whole life. So, and for sure the film industry that now we identify as an industry was one of his interests, but mostly it was about an idea that could serve the community but could also be profitable. And in fact, we see the progressive involvement of Bank of Italy into financing Nickelodeons and the transition to cinema theaters.
There was one project, indeed, that sort of started them into Nickelodeons.
So we know that Saul Lesser, who was, later producer in Hollywood, when he was a minor, so he was underage, he was looking for some funding to buy some extra seats for his Nickelodeon, somehow thinking that, okay, the principle of the Nickelodeon is that you need one person at a time to watch the film, but if he managed to get more than one seat, then he could sell more than one ticket to watch just, the same print. But no one would loan him money, first of all, because he was a minor, but second of all, because it was something new. And why would people interested in watching a film? But Giannini realized that it had potential, and he took the loan himself in his name. And then we know that Saul Lesser was able to repay him back in just a matter of a few weeks.
And I mean, then it's too much to list them all, but he got involved in all sorts of projects that we know. Frank Capra, he was involved in funding him.
Yeah, we know some of the directors that were looking for Giannini's support were Charlie Chaplin, Frank Capra, even Walt Disney. The Disney studios were entirely financed by a loan from Bank of Italy. And then later on, Cecil DeMille, even Alfred Hitchcock, and so on. The interesting thing about financing Hollywood was setting up a model, a financing model that could make everyone's life easier. And so, of course, filming and producing back then was as risky as it is today. It wasn't any easier. So Giannini was, and the bank was, providing filmmakers and producers and actors with specific loans for and mortgages to buy their houses and build their houses in Hollywood, because the houses that you see today are the ones that were built in the teens and the 20s and the 30s. And so in that way, the filmmakers couldn't really, they reduced the risk for not completing the film, because the filmmaker knew that it had an impact also on their own house. And the second aspect that Bank of Italy was crucial in when we think about financing Hollywood is that the bank set up a specific financing model that then became the model that we're still using today. And when he died, his personal assets were basically the same as when he started the Bank of Italy. And it was less than $400,000. So he didn't die as a millionaire. Because his idea was that, you don't need to have so much money to make sure that you can have a good life and be useful to the community. And maybe it's good to remind, anytime there is a right conversation about how Hollywood should maybe be less elite and be open to more diversity, it's always good to remember that it started out as a project made by by immigrants, and most importantly funded by immigrant money.
Valentina Signorelli there on A.P. Giannini, and her documentary A.P. Giannini Back to the Future is due out later this year. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more heroic facilitators next Saturday tea time on RTE Lyric FM, and naturally via podcast at a moment of your choosing. Till next time, bye now.